Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to bridging the gap between adventure and adventurer by helping people select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, Robin Hayes, former congressman, former chairman of the North Carolina Republican Party, is indicted in an investigation that may yield yet more indictments. A bill that would compel state sheriffs to cooperate with ICE makes its way through the legislature. Some may be upset by the Mecklenburg County Sheriff expanding his department's role into conducting traffic stops, but not CMPD Chief Kerr Putney. And for the legislature to vote money to give $400 to teachers to buy classroom supplies sounds like a nice idea. But is it? Our roundtable of reporters is ready to detail those and other stories, and those reporters include Eli Portillo, reporter for the Charlotte Observer. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Nick Oxner is here from WBTV News. Welcome.
Long time no see.
Yes, right. You've been away for a while. Glenn Berkins is founder and publisher of QCityMetro.com.
Good morning.
Hello. And Eric Spanberg is the managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Thank you for being here, too.
Good morning, Mike.
We're all on Facebook Live this morning, as a matter of fact. Nick and Eric, the backs of your heads look splendid. Former congressman and up until this week, chairman of the...
Chairman.
Is he still chairman?
Yes.
Well, he's still chairman until June, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Much to some consternation, but sorry.
Well, of the North Carolina Republican Party, Robin Hayes became one of four people indicted in connection with an investigation involving donations made to the state GOP. What do these indictments charge?
Well, what they allege is that a Durham billionaire named Greg Lindberg, who owns a conglomerate of insurance companies, among other things, that alleges that Lindberg and two of his employees had a scheme in which they wanted to bribe North Carolina Insurance Commissioner Mike Causey, a Republican, and part of the way in which they wanted to do that was funneling money through the North Carolina Republican Party. Now, we know that... the North Carolina Republican Party cut a roughly $250,000 check out of its account to Mike Causey's campaign sometime, I think, last year. And that money came from Greg Lindberg. We know that because Dallas Woodhouse told me that on the record in October.
Would that contribution have been outside the limits of what is legal?
Not outside. So that's exactly the rub, right? That is not outside the limits for the North Carolina Republican Party to make such a contribution to a candidate, because the party can do that. It is well outside the limits for what Greg Lindberg, an individual, could do, because the maximum there is $5,200. And so the rub here, the party said, look, we don't think we broke the law because it is illegal to make a directed contribution, right, for Lindberg to give money, because he gave $2 million roughly total to the Republican Party. It would be illegal for Lindberg to then say you need to give some of that to Causey, because then you'd be exactly going around the contribution limits. So the party admitted, hey, we did this kind of thing sort of in a way that was legal, giving money from Lindberg to Causey. They owned that in October. On Tuesday, however, in the unsealed indictment, the Fed said no, that was not legal. So Hayes, Lindberg, and Lindberg's two employees are charged with bribery-related crimes. Robin Hayes also faces an additional three counts of lying to the FBI that the federal officials say happened during an interview in August.
So the reasons, or the alleged reasons, that this money was donated to the state GOP was an attempt to get the insurance commissioner to remove, as I understand it, a deputy commissioner who had been overseeing a state investigation into Mr. Lindberg's company. How is Robin Hayes allegedly involved in this?
Well, so we also know that in the meeting that there were probably multiple meetings, but at least one of those meetings between Robin Hayes, Greg Lindberg, and Mike Causey, Lindberg said, I'm going to give you this money. I'm paraphrasing here, obviously, but I'm going to give you this money, and you're going to give it to Causey. And Hayes allegedly said, we'll send it wherever you want us to. And we know that Mike Causey made a surreptitious recording of at least one meeting between Lindberg himself and Robin Hayes for the FBI. And we should note that Mike Causey went to the FBI in January of 2018. He participated in the scheme as a undercover person for the FBI, and he will not face any charges as a result.
And what you're getting at, Nick, is the idea of steering those general donations to a specific candidate. That is where the problems start.
Yes.
So when the FBI asked Robin Hayes about illegal campaign contributions to the North Carolina Growth and Prosperity Committee and to Mike Causey's campaign account, he said absolutely not to a question of whether Lindbergh had expectations for a quid pro quo in all of this. And this was seen as untrue. So that's why he's been charged with three counts of lying to the
FBI. He made other statements, too, that he had never discussed employees of the Department of, according to the indictment, that he had never discussed employees of the Department of Insurance with Mike Causey, and there was a third one. That's why he's charged three different counts.
So they were accused of trying to, bribe the State Insurance Commissioner, mm-hmm. Mike Causey, with about $2 million. And it ended up being a sting operation because, as you say, in January, Causey went to the FBI, and during one of the was he reluctant at first to or shocked at first by these offers?
Well, he had rejected campaign donations before from Lindbergh and also overtures to host fundraisers.
So as was pointed out in a story that aired this morning from our Steve Harrison, he kind of did a 180 on this because at a secret meeting he asked, what can you do to help help me. That's not going to be under the that's going to be under the radar screen. What can I get out of this?
But he did that at the direction of
right,
the FBI.
At the FBI, yes. Right? So why would you believe that suddenly I've changed my attitude here? Why did they think that was going to work? It did, evidently.
Well, it seems that Lindbergh and his associates were, very, very persistent. You know, they wanted the access. It's interesting and worth noting that the Wall Street Journal had a great story yesterday where Causey went on the record and told them this all started because he had questions that he brought to a federal prosecutor just about this examination that the Department of Insurance was doing of Greg Lindbergh's businesses.
Because when he came into power after the Democrats lost control, evidently his employees told him that there's a cozy arrangement.
Well, it seemed weird.
Okay. And remember, I'm sure we'll dig into this as well. While Lindbergh has mostly given more to Republicans than Democrats, he also has some extensive ties to Democrats, including Causey's predecessor, Wayne Goodwin, who's now head of the Democratic Party. And so Causey has said that under Goodwin's leadership, the insurance department was allowing, or the insurance commissioner, I should say, was allowing loopholes in terms of the investments that the insurance company that Lindbergh owned was making. Instead of the 10% industry standard, it was more like 40%. So there were already questions bubbling up before Causey had even come in.
And there were other reports that when Causey got in, he said, hey, some of his employees were saying, we had to run all the things about one of Greg Lindbergh's companies through a political appointee that seemed strange. Mm-hmm. And so there are questions about that. And then we know he gave a six-figure contribution to the Democratic Party within, I think, last year,
maybe,
in 2017.
Was it $750,000, I think?
Yeah, substantial six-figure contribution.
That was substantial. That's
for the party's building fund and among other things.
Okay. So Causey turned them in to Mike Causey, the insurance commissioner, turned them in to federal authorities, and he told WFAE by doing so, he did the right thing.
When you're sworn into public office, you know, you take an oath to uphold the Constitution of North Carolina and the United States. And I did my duty, and I'll continue to do my duty.
Well, that's refreshing. All four,
isn't it?
All four of these men who were accused in this have pleaded not guilty. How serious are these charges, though?
Very, very serious. And what is more serious? A couple things. One, the U.S. Attorney's Office has made it clear that their public corruption investigation continues. But also, if you recall back to October of last year, the first time this investigation was unveiled because the FBI sent a subpoena to the Department of Insurance and it listed the crimes they were investigating, it was all financial and white-collar crimes related to Greg Lindbergh's businesses. So if you're Greg Lindbergh, you know that you still have the looming federal investigation into your business scheme out there as well. So
Eli.
And I think that the broader context of this has probably got a lot of people in Raleigh nervous. As we mentioned, the head of the Democratic Party, Chair Wayne Goodwin, he's denied he did anything wrong, but he...
He's also been unavailable for comment this week.
He worked as a consultant for a Lindbergh-affiliated company after leaving elected office. Dan Forrest, who is running for governor and is the presumed GOP frontrunner right now.
And he's the lieutenant governor at the moment.
Yep, current lieutenant governor. He's the single biggest recipient of Lindbergh money to Dan Forrest-affiliated PACs. So this money has gone a lot of places in North Carolina politics over the last 5 or 6 years. We're talking about the biggest single donor in the state in Greg Lindbergh. And he's not a household name, but he's certainly really well-known in political circles, and his money has just touched all kinds of campaigns.
And it's worth remembering, to Eli's point, $7.5 million that's been cataloged so far that he has donated, Lindbergh has donated to political candidates and parties, mostly in North Carolina. The second thing I would add to what Eli just mentioned is, while the Republicans have all these problems with Robin Hayes and what's been what's happened so far, remember, on the Democratic side, now you have a fissure within the party of, should this money be returned, with some Democrats saying, well, there are no crimes, there's, you know, nothing's gone wrong, let's keep the money. Others saying, including Jeff Jackson from Mecklenburg County, saying, no, this is dirty money, let's return it. So
just to distance themselves.
Yes.
I believe a representative from from Chatham, I was reading yesterday, said, there can be legal donations from someone who's tainted, and this Democratic representative said we should not give back the money just because the donor's tainted. This is a Republican problem. So there's that split in the Democrats as well. And I think it's also worth noting that this couldn't really be happening at a worse time for the North Carolina Republican Party. I mean, coming on the heels of the 9th District fiasco and the election redo that's been ordered because of alleged voter fraud there, and coming up on a governor campaign, the RNC in Charlotte next year, people directly credited Robin Hayes with helping to bring the RNC and being one of the key figures there. And now he's under indictment, and who knows if he'll be in prison or on trial next year when the RNC's in Charlotte. So this is a party that's got also, I should note, a special election in the 3rd District as well. So a ton going on.
And Eli, on that Republican National Convention aspect, remember, it was just Monday, which seemed like 10 years ago. The press release initially about Robin Hayes saying he would not seek another term, it was nothing but glowing comments about his tenure from luminaries, Senator Tillis, former Governor McCrory, on and on, and specific mentions of all that he had done to bring the Republican National Convention here. I mean, this has to be driving some of the National Party leaders crazy at the moment.
Right. They specifically said Robin Hayes, his efforts brought it here.
Carter Wren, who's a longtime Republican strategist, says, we don't know how deep this goes, but, quote, as far as the state Republican Party goes, this qualifies as a volcano eruption.
I think this is
hyperbole.
No, this will be when it's done, the single biggest political corruption scandal in North Carolina history.
Because it will touch both parties.
It will touch both parties. It will touch a lot of people. Eli talked about Lieutenant Governor Dan Forrest. There's also Republican Congressman Mark Walker. We know the House Republican Caucus and the Speaker Tim Moore took money here. And it involves a lot more layers of individuals. We've just seen the outer layers of an onion start to be.
And that's why more indictments are likely to come down from this, correct?
Which Causey himself said.
Right.
Yeah, Causey has said that, and the U.S. Attorney's Office has hinted at it.
So given the wide range of this potential scandal here and the damage it's already done to the state Republican Party and senior members of that party, what does that say about Mike Causey's backbone to come forward and be part of the sting operation that unveiled it?
Well, this Wall Street Journal article is interesting because he didn't initially call and say, hey, I think there's a bribery thing going on. It just morphed into that.
Okay. That's Nick Oxner, reporter for WBTV News. He's here with Eric Spanberg from the Business Journal, Eli Portillo from the Charlotte Observer, and Glenn Birkins, editor-publisher of Q-City Metro. We're coming back to talk about the ice bill making its way through the North Carolina House. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that believe a car is used for more than just getting from place to place. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup with Eli Portillo, Glenn Birkins, Nick Oxner, and Eric Spanberg, all reporting in for duty as scheduled. Several recently elected sheriffs around North Carolina, including Mecklenburg County Sheriff Gary McFadden, ended their department's cooperation with immigration enforcement and their 287G program when they took office after the November election. And now there's a move in the legislature to compel all state sheriffs to cooperate with ICE. The bill has already gone through the House. What does it do?
Well, it does exactly what you said, which is that sheriff's offices would have to detain people they've arrested for up to 48 hours at the request of ICE. So that would be obviously...
Wouldn't they normally do that?
That they do not have... It's a voluntary...
Okay.
Program right now, and as we've talked about on the show many times, five of the seven most populous counties in the state have sheriffs who have opted not to participate right. in 287G.
Which is different from this.
Which is different, but they're related, I think would be the safest way to say.
Because they deal with ICE.
They deal with ICE. So, and we've talked about this over and over, there is a lot of tension between ICE and the sheriff's departments in Mecklenburg County, Wake County, the larger cities. And I think that what this really illustrates is yet another rural-urban issue when you get into the legislature. So I don't think that this is surprising.
Glenn.
And I would say that it's more than just large counties here in the state or even North Carolina. If you look nationally, very few sheriffs actually participate in this program. There is a feeling that there is a general feeling among local law enforcement that that type of cooperation is counter to public safety in local communities because the Latino communities no longer trust the police departments or the local sheriff's departments. So. Those local law enforcement officers feel that they have to put a little bit of distance between themselves and ICE in order to solve crimes and to keep that community safe.
That's been said repeatedly by Sheriff Gary McFadden and by CMPD Chief Kirk Putney that it makes communities less safe if they associate themselves with the National Immigration Enforcement Organization. This bill was backed by Speaker Tim Moore and other Republicans. Caldwell County Republican State Representative Destin Hall is the lead sponsor of this legislation.
What's happening is certain sheriffs, sanctuary sheriffs in certain counties, are deciding to release individuals charged with serious crimes when they don't have to.
Is that true?
I think Gary McFadden would probably tell you no. In fact, it's interesting to me that he has come out with a long list of things that he's still doing, right? Honoring certain warrants and detainer requests that are lawful that just aren't part of 287G. What I think you hear the rhetoric from Representative Hall, who's been very out front on this issue, and I think this was his idea if you talk to folks in the House, is ramping up kind of this. They see an opportunity for kind of a war of ideas here, and that's what this bill represents.
I think it gets back to the whole fact that it seems like all our politics are national, not local these days. This is really, I think, a distillation of the national debate on immigration with issues like, should we build a wall? What do we do about these so-called caravans that are coming? Really, you've got those same debates bleeding down into the state and local levels now where, you know, immigration is really a national issue. North Carolina and Mecklenburg County are not going to solve the immigration problems we have on our own, yet here we are.
The way I've heard McFadden explain it is that defendants or suspects, whatever, people who are in the county jail who would normally be released legally are being released. So if you do something minor, a traffic stop or something, or driving without a license, then you would be released as anyone else would, as a citizen would be if you are an undocumented person. But if you've committed murder, if you've committed rape, just like anyone else, just like a citizen, you're going to be retained. So it's not so much, I think Sheriff McFadden would say, that they're releasing serious criminals as much as they're treating undocumented inmates the same as they would treat Americans.
And the other side of that argument is you've got them. You've got people who have gotten here under the radar and have broken the law by being here, so you've got them. Don't let them go.
Yeah.
You're helping.
Yes, that is definitely the other side of that argument.
And I was going to mention, of course, Sheriff McFadden, we've talked a lot recently about him appearing at public meetings and having strong opinions. He was before the House Rules Committee this week, and he said, quote, "You've never spoken to me. You never even called me.
No, let him say it.
Oh, if you've got it.
I've got it.
I apologize.
That's okay. Here it is.
You've been misled. I do not release anybody unless a judge tells me to release them. If you want my people to hold these people in the jail, bring me a warrant, not a detainer."
Don't mess with Gary McFadden. That's him talking before, I guess, a House committee in Raleigh. He also accused them of being misinformed. You can read your quote now.
Yeah, I was just going to – the last part of that quote, same voice that you just heard. "So I take offense that you say I may be letting someone out of jail who is dangerous." So going back to the point of, you know, he is saying that the Sheriff's Department is already doing its job. They're not letting people go free who are a threat. So that is the issue here.
You may have said this. I don't know. But he said, as you were reading that quote, "You've never spoken to me. You never even called me." But he did say, "You listen to ICE." So no one's listening to the local people. They've already made up their mind, is what he's saying there, right?
That is what he's saying. And also, as we dig into this, we should note that the Sheriff's Association has come out in opposition to this. Originally, they didn't take a position. Now, they haven't said that the policy of detaining for 48 hours is bad. What they've said is that sheriff's departments should have the leeway to make their own decision because the voters elect those sheriffs to carry out policy.
Let's be clear. The North Carolina Sheriff's Association has come out against this policy not because they are not in favor of detaining people who need to be detained, and not just to take the sides of the sheriffs who are not in compliance, but to say we need operational independence from the state government.
And that is significant because the Sheriff's Association holds a lot of sway in the North Carolina General Assembly and in the court system as well. They're very, very influential. And I actually think it's interesting that the bill passed through the House anyways.
The other thing that I guess shouldn't be overlooked is that Governor Cooper surely is sitting there with his veto pen ready, I would imagine, and the GOP does not have the power to override a veto should it come to that.
But if you're the Republican, if you're a Republican political strategist, you are happy to have the Governor Cooper veto to use. Again, this goes back
to the greater themes.
And to Eli's point from earlier, this started in the 2018 election when these national groups, including the ACLU and others, were very unabashedly behind these sheriff candidates who were challenging outsiders, including now Sheriff McFadden against Sheriff Carmichael, including Gerald Baker, who knocked off longtime Sheriff Donnie Harrison in Wake County. They made this an issue. This was the issue, and they got five knocked off the long time sheriff in Guilford County on because of this. And so
you're right, Nick. That was the one differentiator, really. That was the issue.
Yes, and it got a lot of outside money and really ramped up a campaign the level of which you've not seen normally in a county sheriff's race.
And I think that regardless of whether this bill were to somehow become law or to be vetoed, as is more likely, it's going to continue to be an issue in 2020. As we've seen, this is a potent issue, and the sheriffs, you know, if this became law, they would have a great thing to oppose and become public heroes for that as well in their districts with their voters.
So is this bill now in the hands of the Senate?
Yes.
Okay. What's the timetable on it? Do we know?
Don't know that.
Okay. It seems that every passing year brings more homicides to Charlotte. And again, this year, homicides are up sharply. How many cases have there been in 2019?
So we have 34, right?
34 so far, 33 in the first quarter. They don't rise every year. They kind of go up and down.
Last year was actually down.
Yes, last year was actually down. What was different about this year is it took a gigantic leap up. It went from 10 in the first quarter of last year to 33 in the first quarter of this year, and there has been one so far in April. If you look at the breakdown, there have been six related to domestic violence, four were drug-related, five were robberies, seven stemmed from arguments, one was an officer-involved shooting, and 10 were unknown causes.
And in most cases, the victims knew the assailant.
In most cases, yes.
And I was just going to say, Glenn, I think you've talked about this on the show, too, the fact that over and over when we have discussed this or heard the CMPD chief, others from the police department, they have talked about people resolving issues with guns almost immediately. I mean, that has resonated throughout these trends.
This is something that Kerr Putney has talked about repeatedly in the community, that people are resorting to using guns to settle the simplest things instead of just having a face-to-face argument about it, and the department has called this a shocking number. It also says it's a problem that's much bigger than CMPD, and it stems from more people resorting to guns. Are they saying this is something that the police cannot solve?
Well, they're saying it's something that the police cannot prevent, and they did talk about that. I think the most frightening and perhaps egregious example of people settling their disputes with guns involved the 27-year-old mom who was just caught in the crossfire, driving home, I would presume, from somewhere, and she was caught in crossfire and killed, mother of two, because according to investigators, three men decided they would have a shootout on a public street.
And also a prosecutor's car, he was not hit, but one of the bullets, I believe, hit his car. So the other thing that I believe it was Chief Putney said this week is they're very frustrated and concerned because people who are shooting victims and survive are reluctant to talk about the circumstances and who may have done it.
Yep. He says young people especially will not cooperate.
All we can do is assume that there's some issues going on that we need to break through culturally. Because if you're not going to help us bring people to justice, we're going to have a lot of families who are suffering who never get closure.
So this translates into police being unable to solve nearly a third of this year's homicides. That's 10 out of 33, and they're appealing to gun owners to help. How?
Well, gun owners, they're asking them to make sure their weapons are secured, they're not, you know, left in a vehicle overnight, that they're secured when they're in the home, something like a safe with, you know, good locks on it. 90% of the homicides so far this year in Charlotte have used a gun. It's by far the most common method. And Chief Putney has said many of those weapons are stolen. I think if you multiply it out, we're on pace for about 132 or so murders this year.
Right.
And that would be a record in Charlotte. There have been times before when we've been on pace to break the previous record, but it hasn't happened. I think that sort of compressed spate of violence, though, is really unusual for Charlotte, and especially that shootout in which the young mother was killed. You know, that was at about 5:15 p.m. on a weekday, about a mile from uptown Charlotte. This is not a city that has a lot of shootouts in the middle of the afternoon on very busy streets in which people driving about their day are killed. To me, that's a really shocking homicide.
I agree. And I think that struck a lot of people, exactly the circumstances you just described. That's not something that's common in Charlotte. I think that really set a lot of people back. Obviously, any of these are horrible, but the circumstances of that one were particularly jarring.
We've had a number this year that had the potential to go that way. I remember others. One was at a gas station where someone was shot and killed. We've had they're not all occurring in a private residence or off to off on some dark alley. Some of these shootings are happening in very public places where innocent lives could be taken.
CMPD Chief Kerr Putney will be with us on Tuesday on this program to talk about that and other things, including perhaps his welcoming of the sheriff's expanded role in police activities. We talked last week or the week before, I've forgotten which now, about the reaction in Cornelius to Mecklenburg County Sheriff Gary McFadden's traffic control operations on a Sunday afternoon on Jaton Road. It was a surprise to residents, and it resulted in some tense moments between the Cornelius Town Commission or Council and Gary McFadden, who was invited there to talk to them. And he accused them and those in attendance of being privileged people who didn't like to be interfered with. I'm paraphrasing there, but nonetheless, it was fairly outspoken. The fact that these traffic control measures actually surprised a lot of Mecklenburgers, they didn't know that the Sheriff's Department had that power to do that. Only police can do that. No, not true. The Mecklenburg Sheriff's Department can do it, and they plan to do it even more. And this week, Kerr Putney said he has no problem with this. move to expand a sheriff's law enforcement profile. Has there been any reaction to that comment?
To the reaction that he has no problem? I have not. No, I've not heard the reaction to that. But, I think all of us around this table found that very interesting, because Sheriff McFadden has said pretty loudly and emphatically that he is going to broaden what the sheriff's department does.
Is that because of his police department
background? I think that's a lot of it, because he knows that job.
And the other interesting thing to me about the current uproar about this is actually the department purchased radar detectors and sent deputies. So you have to be trained on the use of radar, and you have to buy the equipment to do stuff like that. Mm-hmm. That actually all happened under Sheriff Carmichael. No one knew about it because they had never actually used it. In fact, he bragged about it at a thing. One of my colleagues is that one day we tried to do a story about it. They didn't want to talk about it after that. So this isn't new, but certainly he's making good use of it.
Whenever there's a traffic enforcement action such as those, there are always things that that they find, and they usually list those things. So many people were driving without a license. So many people without registration. So many people had drugs or guns or what have you. A lot of people end up in the criminal justice system based on traffic stops. Those traffic stops disproportionately have always been in poor and minority communities. What the sheriff is doing is taking those traffic stops to some of our more affluent communities. And it's going to be interesting to see if it will result in that same collateral damage, more people entering the criminal justice system because they had marijuana in their car when they were pulled over, and the sheriff's deputy smelled it. Is that why he's doing it?
Because it's making a point that it's not just people in the black community that do these things; it's everybody everywhere.
Well, that calls for speculation, and I'm not going to speculate why he's doing it, but I feel confident that there will be people who are entered into the criminal justice system who ordinarily would not have been entered into the criminal justice system because they never would have had an encounter with law enforcement.
Interesting.
And the sheriff has said that, you know, they identified a traffic hotspot in Cornelius where there was a lot of speeding, where there had been some fatalities, and that's how they picked that spot, and that they're going to continue to use those criteria. On CMPD's side, they've had issues with staffing. They've had issues with a lot of retirements. They haven't been able to hire the number of officers they want to get up to full staffing. And at the same time, Charlotte has seen increasing traffic fatalities, a record number of pedestrian fatalities for the last 2 years. So Charlotte is arguably a city that needs more traffic enforcement. So this is speculation, but I can see Chief Putney saying, well, we don't have enough officers, and we need more traffic enforcement. Thanks for the help.
Yeah, you do that, and we'll focus on serious stuff like shootings and things like that. When we come back, we'll talk about the proposal in the legislature to give $400 directly to school teachers to buy their own classroom supplies, about streetcar construction slowing just in time for the convention, and about coal ash removal, among other things. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the weekly news roundup with Glenn Birkins, editor-publisher, QCityMetro.com, Nick Oxner from WBTV News, Eric Spanberg from the Charlotte Business Journal, and Eli Portillo from the Charlotte Observer. Just ahead of a scheduled teacher march on Raleigh in, I think, next month, it was announced that some North Carolina lawmakers want to give teachers $400 to spend on classroom supplies. Why and where did this idea come from?
State Senator Andy Wells from Catawba County, I think, was one of the lead sponsors of this. And what they're trying to do is take about $37 million of the existing $47 million state fund that goes to the school systems for school supplies. And the argument that Mark Johnson, the state superintendent, and Senator Wells and others are making is that by giving the teachers the $400 and control over the $400, they can truly put the money where it would best serve
classroom. Yes, because one of those lawmakers alleges that the money has not been properly spent by the, quote, bureaucrats who run these school systems. Really?
Yes, correct. And so you have that piece of it. And then on the other side, Mike, you have teachers and education groups who are saying that you're, in fact, hurting the school systems. Charles Jeter, the lobbyist for CMS, also said this, that when you take away that bulk buying power, that you're actually spending more money, getting less bang for the buck, and by the way, they don't have enough as it is.
Which is why Charles Jeter, who used to be in the legislature and is now Charlotte-Mecklenburg School Government Relations Coordinator, had this to say.
If this was new money, it'd be one of the most impressive things the General Assembly has done in years, but it's not. All this is transferring who controls the spending to the detriment of the teachers they're trying to assist.
So this would be detrimental in his mind to the teachers because they would be buying these classroom supplies that they think they need. They're the people on the ground, on the front lines, so they know what they need. But they'd be buying this stuff through an app at retail prices.
Right.
So the $400 spent by teachers would not go as far as the $400 that would go through the system because they buy wholesale.
Right. I mean, that's just easy, basic business and math. So
why can't it be set up that they get the deal, the wholesale deal? Why does it have to go through Staples or Office Depot or Office Max?
Bureaucracy.
That's my only guess is bureaucracy.
Well, and so that it's interesting. There was a long Twitter debate thread that played out yesterday between Jeter and the governor's office, communications director Sadie Weiner, and some folks in the General Assembly. And Jeter's ultimate point is, you don't know how we're spending the school supplies money we get now. And by the way, you give us so little, we have to go to the county to supplement our school supplies money, to which the Republicans said, well, come back and show us how you're spending it, and maybe we'll trust you a little bit more. You could argue, though, this is good intentions, wrong execution.
Yeah, right.
Even with going to the county or whatever, if you know teachers and you talk with them, they're still spending still spend out of their own pockets.
So State Senator Andy Wells, who is the Catawba County Republican who came up with this idea, the primary sponsor of the bill, says that bureaucrats use the money to pay for other things on their to-do list and leave teachers to pay for their own classroom supplies. Is there some truth in that?
We don't know.
Right,
I mean, point blank, Brent Woodcox, who's a lawyer on the Senate Republican staff under Phil Berger, who would presumably be supporting Andy Wells in his legislative proposal, said on Twitter yesterday, well, do you have a breakdown? He asked, and Jeter said, we're preparing that. So no one has it yet. No one's looked at the line item breakdown.
You'll be shocked, Mike, but we're having a fight about things we don't actually have the answers to in our political realm. That's unprecedented.
So Leon Winter, who's already been referenced here, the director of governmental relations, i.e. lobbyist, for the North Carolina School Boards Association, says she's not aware of any school districts using funds for unintended purposes. How is she confirming that if we don't know how it's being
spent? Well, unaware is very opaque.
Yes.
Look,
yeah,
here's the bottom line. Would it surprise me one bit to see line item transfers out of the school supply budget into other places in any one of the 100-plus school districts around the state? No. Would it also surprise me to know that most of it's being used as supposed to? Also no.
By the way, Nick, that's never happened in the legislature itself, right? They don't.
No.
But they didn't get to write the budget.
So now
that's a key point.
Have we heard from teachers about this idea?
Well, we know, for example, that the North Carolina Teacher of the Year, who was scheduled to appear at the press conference supporting this legislation, ultimately backed out and just said that she did not think this was, quote, the right choice for teachers. So I think that's probably an indication of where teachers.
So, and just so people will know, they would buy these supplies using the Class Wallet app. Is there any connection between the manufacturers, inventors, the people who hand out the Class Wallet app, and the legislature? In other words, is there money to be made here?
I don't know the answer to that question. I believe it was specified, wasn't it, that they don't get money from the state. They get money from their relationship with the retailers. Now, that doesn't answer your first question, but that's a partial answer.
Okay. You may have heard the Republican National Convention is coming to Charlotte in 2020, and the Charlotte Area Transit System had hoped to have had the second phase of the streetcar up and running along by convention time. And now CATS Chief John Lewis says that's not going to happen, and part of the blame is being put on the convention.
It's the first time this has happened, a construction project, a transit project in a city that is having a convention.
Don't know if that's true or not, but why is the convention slowing things down?
Well, you have some security issues that would require them to stop construction. Is it 30 days before you?
60 left? To 90 days.
60 to 90 days. Thank you. So 60 to 90 days. So that's the first part of it. But the city manager, Marcus Jones, pointed out that that is hardly the sole cause of their delays.
May I put my old man hat on?
You were going to do it anyways.
That's right.
It was already on, as a matter of fact.
I never take it off.
That's what I was going to ask. When does he take off that hat?
Okay, let me just pose this to you. In the 1970s, you remember the 1970s, don't you, Eli?
Yes. No. Some of us were born in 1989. Go on.
In the 1970s, they built this thing called the Metro Subway System in our nation's capital, and the entire city for years was torn up with explosions going on underground, with roads covered with wooden planks because 60 feet down they were building a subway tunnel. They did not move, the last time I checked, they did not move the United States government or the president out of Washington for that period of construction. If they can do that, why can't we build one measly little line that runs down one measly little street past one measly little building? Why can't we do that?
Get off my White House lawn!
So what John Lewis, the CATS CEO, ended up saying was that they will hopefully, he says, be done with the actual construction, but the federal government requires an uninterrupted period of testing for about 4 months before they're allowed to put passengers on it. He says,
well, I ask once again, why RNC can't that go on while people are here for the convention?
Well, what Lewis has said is that the Secret Service and other federal agencies DHS have said that there can't be any construction or construction-related activities in the secure bubble during that time. But I think, as Eric said, Marcus Jones, the city manager, actually walked that back at the same meeting and said there have been other problems with this line than it was trending this way anyway. So now they're going to probably have it open, they say, in early 2021, which, considering it's a 2.5-mile extension, will put us at well over a year and a half per mile of construction time when this is all said and done. So by early 2021, we might have that open. I think it's also worth noting that another thing John Lewis said is that the current streetcar that's open now is actually going to shut down this summer for 8 months so that they can raise the station platforms by 6 to 8 inches to accommodate new cars.
Right.
So not only will there be streetcar construction going through 2021, the current streetcar is about to go out of commission for pretty much the rest of this year.
Because we built a thing that was going to be obsolete like 2 years after we opened it, knowing that.
Because look who's got a young, grumpy old man hat on.
Oh, yeah, I might be 29, but I'm just as old in spirit as Mike Collins.
Well, and city council was also pretty openly skeptical, some of the members, about future phases of the streetcar. Ed Driggs asked if that would cost between $300 and $400 million. John Lewis said that's probably a rough ballpark figure. And it's worth noting that all of that money, the way it's structured now, would have to come out of Charlotte's general fund, because the streetcar is not funded by transit funds or the half-cent sales tax that other transit lines CATS operates benefits from.
Ding, 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 ding. That's the most important point there.
So the streetcar's future, I think,
I should
is
say clang, clang, clang,
in doubt. unless they find a new funding source or council gets a lot more enthusiastic about it, because they're going to have to take that money from the same pot that funds, you know, the police department, the fire department, everything else the city does locally, and that's a big ask.
And the other subplot running through this story is that fairy tales do come true. It can happen to you if you're young at heart. Just know that. Okay, as we recall, it was a surprise to those on city council not too long ago that the city was going to come up $77 million short of the money needed to complete the Cross Charlotte Trail because it was not initially budgeted properly. And now emails obtained by WBTV show that city employees knew this before council members. How long before, Nick?
Months before, not only before they told council, but also they knew it before the November 2018 vote where the transportation bonds were on the ballot. They got approved, and $5 million of the $50 million transportation bonds went to the Cross Charlotte Trail. So the emails obtained by my colleague David Hodges show that staff knew this for months and months, and if you read the email traffic back and forth, they said, ooh, this is going to be bad. Let's think about how we roll this out before we just tell people.
Really? So there were mentions of not wanting to inform council members, at least not immediately, until they thought this through?
And the emails, correct me if I'm wrong, Nick, because it's a WBTV story, but the emails sort of danced around the issue. The answer was not that they weren't going to tell, but how do they tell and when do they tell?
That's exactly, yeah. There was never like a, we're going to keep this secret right. always.
Why is that a difficult story to tell? Why would that be a concern for people who did not make the mistake in the first place to tell a council that wasn't around when the mistake was made in the first place? Why would that be difficult to tell?
One gets the impression that they were afraid of letting the cat out of the bag on the shortfall before they got some of the other projects approved. They say that's not connected. But there's an email exchange where they run into a member of the staff runs into
Greg Phipps.
Yeah, who asked specifically about this, and they said, and someone reports back to their boss, hey, I had this conversation with Councilman Phipps, and they said, I'll reach out to him, but don't make any specific promises until we know if we're going to fully brief the council on this.
Well, and remember at the council retreat in January, there was this whole, Eli, I know, was there. There was this whole back and forth about the way that project costs are estimated, and Marcus Jones, the city manager, again, essentially said, look, this has not been done well, not just with Cross Charlotte, and that they were going to have to basically revamp the way they estimate prices and costs.
And, you know, I think in the end, it probably ended up somewhat blowing up in the city staff's face that they didn't make this briefing sooner, because a lot of city council members ended up being very upset that they weren't explicitly told, hey, we are $77 million short. We don't know how we're going to fund this. Then there were a lot of questions about how long did you know? I think that overall, this also ties back to projects like the streetcar, because one of the ways that the city could make up for this funding shortfall is to reach into the general fund and pull some money to help fund the Cross Charlotte Trail. But these projects, these big infrastructure projects, are all looking at that same pot of money, along with people like CMPD who want more money for police officers. And the city is really going to have some tough choices over the next few years about how they grow and spend the general fund money.
So the State Department of Environmental Quality has ordered Duke Energy to excavate coal ash from the six remaining coal-fired power plants in the state that don't already have closure plans. Before we talk about what this means, will Duke appeal?
Can they actually appeal?
Yeah, okay. They can.
They seemed less than thrilled.
Yeah. I think that's very fair.
But I couch it mildly, because they didn't explicitly say one way or the other either in their statement. They said, look, this is going to add $5 billion to a $5 billion project.
Double the cost of the cleanup.
That's exactly correct. They said they have claimed all along that the ones that this wasn't ordered at already, they could do it safely. There are obviously lots of people who disagree with that.
Who would pay for this?
Well, now that's the question. I always love that question over at the Business Journal. We love that question. If you look at the track record, it's been the customers.
Yes.
And look, there was a ruling last year by the Utilities Commission. I think it was over $500 million. It was knocked back a little bit with a $70 million fine against Duke Energy. But certainly, they have said consistently, and will say again, that this is part of the cost of them providing, or has been the cost of them providing, reliable electricity to all customers, and so that customers would share in that burden.
And not the stockholders.
But Attorney General Josh Stein has already said he does not believe ratepayers should have to pay for this, and he would be the one responsible for trying to keep that from happening in any future rate case.
So these coal ash collection ponds, or whatever you want to call them, pits that are all over the state, many of them have been here for well over a century. And the federal government has never classified coal ash as a hazardous substance. Look, we've done 1,000 shows on this. They've never classified it as a hazardous substance. So why is our Department of Environmental Quality saying that it's the only way to prevent public health, protect public health and the environment?
So I think the oldest coal ash ponds in our area date back to the 50s or 60s, I believe, but at least a half century old. And the federal standard actually still remains. This was the big debate in the McCrory administration. What should the toxin level be? The federal standard continues to be...
How can there be toxin levels if it's not hazardous?
Because we know coal ash contains toxic substances. I mean, that is...
Does the federal government know this?
They do, but so take hexavalent chromium, one of the most toxic substances in coal ash. The federal government standard is only for total chromium, because there's a kind of chromium that isn't toxic. And so, bureaucracy.
Can you explain that in 10 seconds?
No. So where will this go if they have to remove it very quickly?
Who knows? Stay tuned.
And that's a topic for another roundup.
Lucky there.
Thank you. Nick Oxter from WBTV, Glenn Birkins, QCityMetro.com, Eli Portillo of the Charlotte Observer, Eric Spanberg, the Charlotte Business Journal. Thanks for the hour. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to helping customers select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.